everybody. Shalom. Good morning. I am sitting here in the McMaster University Student Center near the elevator bays, because when you share a house with five other people, 8 a.m. on a Sunday morning is maybe not the ideal time to be speaking at this volume into a microphone. So I'm at the Student Center. You might hear some bells and elevator doors opening from time to time. We're just going to try this out, see how it goes. If this location turns out to be a bust, we'll go somewhere else next time. But in any case, that's where I am. And wherever you are, welcome. And it's great to have you here. This week, what we're going to talk about, I say this week, well, let's get into that in a second. What we're going to talk about today on today's podcast, how about that? So we're going to talk about the textual criticism, the textual tradition of the Old Testament. What we mean by that is basically the history of the Old Testament. And those of you who have been reading the blog posts, this was outlined for you very basically on the blog post earlier this past week. The purpose for today is to go quite a bit deeper with that and maybe flesh out some of those ideas a little bit more, talk a little bit more about specifics and why it might be important. What are some of the implications for some of the facts that I'm throwing out at you? So we're going to get to that in just a second. What I want to do first, though, this is the first podcast of many, and where we're trying to go with this, okay, is this time we're talking about the Old Testament. Our next podcast, we will talk about the same textual history of the New Testament. So that'll be coming. And then eventually where we want to get with this little mini-series is we want to talk about these two ideas that float around in church, in scholarship, called inerrancy and inspiration. The inerrancy of the Bible as God's infallible, inerrant word recorded for us for all time. We want to deal with that. And then we're going to deal with the inspiration of Scripture, meaning that God somehow inspired the Scriptures, the Old and New Testament. They're two different ideas. And our understanding of what the Bible actually is and the value of what it has to communicate is really going to flow pretty directly from our personal and community understanding of those two concepts. So that's where we're trying to get. And once we've established that, okay, that'll be a couple podcasts down the line. Once we've established what are the options in front of us as far as inerrancy and inspiration, that's going to give us the tools that we need to then proceed to talk about some other New Testament issues, specifically Jesus and how do we know that Jesus existed, for example. When Jesus says certain things, certain claims that he throws out at us, or that are recorded for us to believe, to what extent should we put confidence in those claims? To what extent should we be wrestling with some of the ideas that Jesus puts forward, or that the writers of the New Testament want us to believe about Jesus? How does that line up with our modern realities? You know, this past week I've been hearing a lot of commentary about two specific issues, and this is going to sort of put the timestamp on this particular podcast. Two issues that have really been in the news this past week that have been on a lot of people's minds, and I've seen a lot of commentation or comments about this. One, of course, is that we had another school shooting at a university in Oregon. And obviously that's, as unfortunately these events grow to be more and more common, these kinds of tragedies, we're getting a lot of commentary from sort of a lot of the predictable angles, whether it focuses around gun control, whether it focuses on the more existential crisis that we have in the States or elsewhere as far as why is this happening, how is this happening. Those kinds of discussions are going on, but I got to be honest, they don't sound that different from what we heard at Columbine, what we've heard at Newtown, what we've heard everywhere in between. It seems like everyone's kind of got their talking points, and with something as tragic and as senseless as these shootings, talking points are probably not serving us well. So that's one thing in the news. The other thing is the refugee crisis. mainly in Syria, but some other areas of the Middle East and further out as well. But Syria has really been the one dominating the coverage. And Humans of New York, the blog post, has been doing a fantastic and heartbreaking series the last week or two, as Brandon's been going to places in Turkey and Greece where the Syrian refugees have ended up and getting their stories and snapping a photo or two of them and their families. And boy, you go and read those stories and you start to realize the scope and the magnitude of human oppression that is going on over there. So why do I bring these up? I bring these up, I apologize for any background noise, I've picked up a bit of a cold here, so. And you know what, we're not going to edit. That's my deal to you, we're not going to edit what I record unless it's just something really bad. Some noise in the background that makes this unintelligible, but we're going to do this as much in real time as possible. Okay, side note. The reason why I bring up these two current events is because I want to ground our discussion of the Old and New Testament ultimately in its relevance for today, because it's really sort of pointless for us to talk about theology for theology's sake. Theology doesn't exist very well in a vacuum. In fact, it's sort of the worst place for theology to exist. Theology without a practical application in the modern day is worse than pointless. It's dangerous. And it gives people with way too much free time way too much to think about. So as we launch into this series and this semester's worth of podcasts, you know, we are going to be talking, and I'm going to be bringing to you a lot of information that may go against some of what you've been taught about the Scripture. And I want you to know right now that I'm conscious of that fact. Okay, so the history of the Scriptures, right, is what we're talking about here. What I don't want for us to do is just to say, oh, well, okay, so everyone lied to us who taught us Scripture in the past. This is all just a bunch of hooey, and turns out that the history of the Scriptures is far too complex and complicated to make it anything legitimate for me or anyone I know to base their life on, so I'm just going to forget the whole thing. And oh, by the way, thanks, Steve, for letting us know that we should just chuck it all into the trash, because it's an unreliable document, the Scriptures. Okay, that's exactly where we don't want to land. And it's not what I believe. It's not what the conclusion that I hope you come to. But I'm putting this out there because I don't want anyone to guide. Well, I want people to guide your conclusions, but I certainly don't want anyone to come to your conclusions for you. Meaning, the point of all this is to give you the information that might help you come to your own conclusion. And obviously, isn't that the point of learning? Isn't that the point of teaching? Is to get people to a place for them to make their own decision and to come to their own conclusions based on not just the evidence presented, but how do we synthesize that evidence? How do we make sense of it? How do we make it relevant for today's world? I think we make a really big mistake with these kinds of topics if we think that the goal is just to attack sacred cows, right? If the goal is just to knock the Scripture and its authority down several pegs and to sort of demean and degrade the people who have been instructed to teach us the Scriptures, the Old and New Testament, to degrade their authority. If we think that's the point, then we've made a horrible mistake, and we might as well just not bother. You know, oh, look how enlightened and smart we are, right, for having done this, because no one's ever thought to do this before. If all we're setting out to do is to deconstruct the significance of the Bible, we might as well just not bother. Just say we don't believe it and be done with it. That's not the goal. The goal, instead of all of that, is to start at the beginning. We want to understand what the Bible is, and we want to understand what the Bible isn't. And we want to do this objectively as possible. This discussion is going to form the backbone, the skeleton of understanding that we want to reanimate. Now, if you think of this, I thought of this analogy the other day, or this picture, I guess. Right now, you know, let's say we find the bones of a mammoth underground, right? Some bog up in Steamboat Springs, or where was it? Snowmass. A couple years ago, they found the preserved mammoth, right? So we're going to find the bones and the skeleton. And what we're, so our task is to rebuild and reconstruct this mammoth, and eventually to breathe life into it, to make it walk, talk, and breathe again. I don't know if mammoths talked. They made some kind of noise. So if that's our goal, we find a bunch of bones in a bog, and we're going to make it back into a mammoth. And that's our goal. So if we use that analogy for what we're doing here with this set of podcasts and blog posts, where we're at today is we're putting together the backbone. We're putting together the skeleton. We are putting together the essentials of what eventually we will put skin and fur on, and way down the line we will breathe life into. I don't know if that analogy makes any sense whatsoever, but that's just the picture I thought of last night. So I mentioned to you, you know, we're eventually going to get to the idea of inerrancy and inspiration. Not the same idea, but both must be wrestled with in their own rights and in their own way. If we want to eventually understand Jesus and the New Testament, and then extrapolate 2,000 years of church tradition into 21st century living, then we need to first grapple with these ideas of inerrancy and inspiration. So hopefully that gives you an idea where we're heading. With that, let's launch into our textual history of the Old Testament. Okay, so let's launch into the textual history of the Old Testament here. I had a section which I think we'll probably give a pass on for right now. Section on the evolution of the writing styles and the way in which thoughts were recorded in the ancient Near East. So this would encompass the earlier parts of what we now call the Old Testament. Suffice it to say, we're not going to go through the whole history of it. You probably saw this in seventh grade world history class and never want to revisit it again. And unless you're really involved with it and involved in the field, quite honestly, I don't know that we need to cover all these details. But suffice it to say that the writing styles of the ancient Near East and the philosophies that guided how thoughts were recorded by scribes, you know, literacy rates in this part of the world at this time were absurdly low. I mean, you basically had people who worked for a government. Their official job was a scribe, someone who records thoughts, ideas, correspondence between one kingdom and another. Literacy is a very refined art, teaching literacy. You had very few people who truly could read and write during most of the ancient Near Eastern time period. So the people who were privileged enough to be able to do this usually were employed by a government, maybe a very wealthy landowner or something like that. But the way that thoughts come to be written just before the Israelites emerge onto the scene, so we're talking 1500, 1400 BCE, we have preserved Canaanite tablets, okay? These are the same Canaanites who are condemned throughout much of the Old Testament because of their mythology and their worship of these other gods besides Yahweh, right? But we have preserved some of their tablets. And the way that they were recording ideas is sort of this cuneiform wedge script. And so they would have these different arrangements of wedges that they would sort of tap into a stone tablet, or that they would etch later on onto a papyrus scroll or something like that. So we have to locate, what I'm trying to do here is to locate the ancient Israelites, the same people who would have been beginning to write down these ideas contained in the Old Testament, and eventually the books themselves. How were they doing that? You know, physically, how are they actually writing these things down? Well, they were probably, at first, they were using a script very similar to these early Canaanite scripts, okay? They were using wedges and then making different arrangements of these wedges, okay? Now, we have preserved early copies of some of the Old Testament, and it's in what people will generally call a proto-Hebrew script. Paleo-Hebrew sometimes is referred to. Paleo-Hebrew is actually what most of the Old Testament would have probably originally been inscribed on. there's a switch that happens from Paleo-Hebrew to the Hebrew that we would see like in a synagogue or, you know, in even a modern Hebrew newspaper today. That's more of a square script. That switch didn't happen until around 300 BCE. So most of the Old Testament, when we picture Jeremiah sitting down and actually writing his original copy of the book of Jeremiah, he would have been using this system of Paleo-Hebrew script, okay? But by the first century CE, the first century AD, the square script was firmly in place, and that's the script that we use today in Hebrew. Now, what were these scrolls? You know, let's think about the Old Testament. Let's define the Old Testament in terms of not a single book, because I don't find that to be particularly helpful when we're trying to talk about the history of the Old Testament. It didn't come as a single book. It came as multiple scrolls over hundreds and hundreds of years being written by multitudes of different people, okay? So the Old Testament wasn't collected into a single book that we would call something resembling the Old Testament. That didn't happen until around the time of Christ, okay? Maybe a century or two before that, and the Jewish scribes come together and the religious leaders, and they sort of begin to have these councils, the same way that the church would have councils, and they would decide, you know, which book should be in the canon. So that didn't happen until much later. So you have to imagine these scrolls for a long time are sort of existing off by themselves, and they're being copied and recopied, and they're being circulated to different parts of the ancient Near East, okay, to the Israelite and Judah kingdoms. So these aren't books, they're scrolls. They were written on a scroll. Now, what material are they using? They're probably using some kind of papyrus. They're probably using some kind of leather that they're inscribing on. And as we talked about in the blog, it's very difficult for these materials to survive long term. We have the scrolls that were found that, you know, you've probably heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, these were scrolls that were found in the caves of Qumran out in the middle of the desert next to the Dead Sea. And they were found in these jars. The only reason that any of those scrolls survived at all for us to find them in the modern day is because they were untouched for almost 2,000 years. Not only were they untouched, but they were being stored in a climate of extremely low humidity. And they were being sheltered from the elements in these caves. And even then, there's a lot of these scrolls had already disintegrated by the time that we found them back in, you know, the early 20th century. So, you know, when I tell you that we don't have the original scroll of Isaiah, the one that Isaiah himself actually sat down and wrote out, when I tell you that we don't have that original, or we don't have the original copy of Psalm 19, for example, you know, that shouldn't scandalize you. That shouldn't really surprise you. Because the likelihood that would have survived is extremely low under the best conditions. You know, there was no British Museum in 800 BC. These artifacts are at risk from the elements. When war comes, they're at risk of that, of being destroyed in the process of invasions. So it shouldn't surprise us when I tell you that we don't have the originals of these books of the Old Testament. That's not that scandalous. It might be surprising, but it shouldn't be scandalous to you. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Let's just talk another minute about that. When they went into these caves and found these scrolls that were preserved, these scrolls date between 300 and 135, well, sorry, 300 BC to 135 AD or so. They're all dating from the time of Christ, a little bit before, a little bit after, right? And most of them were written between the 3rd and 1st centuries BC. We find copies in this cave of every single Old Testament book except for Esther. So pretty much the entire canon of the Old Testament, there are copies, at least portions of these books found in the Qumran caves. And really what that tells us then is that by 300, 200 BC, all of the books that we consider as part of the Old Testament were being circulated, were being recopied, and were in use. In other words, by that time, they had already gained enough authority that the community at Qumran decided it was worthwhile to have these things lying around, right? Okay, so let's get our bearings and figure out where we're at right now. We've started around 1500 BCE, and you've got Canaanite groups of people writing down the legend of Baal. Okay, this is this Canaanite god who lives on top of the mountain. Baal, Asherah, who turns out to be the wife either of Baal or of El, it depends on which text you read, but you have all of these Canaanite myths, Canaanite religion, that's being recorded. And at the same time, we're probably getting the first oral tradition, the first few copies of the religion of Yahweh. Okay, so this is eventually going to become the God of Israel. So probably 1500, 1400 BC, the Israelites are beginning to record their history. They're going through the Exodus, or pretty soon thereafter, they're going to go through the Exodus, and they begin to write down some of their history, and they begin to write down their law code, which is in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And so this is happening for the next 1,000 years. The Israelites are recording bits and pieces of their history, right? And then we get to the fall of the northern and southern kingdom. So at a certain point, this would be the 700s BC for the northern kingdom and the 500s BC for the southern kingdom of Judah. At a certain point in Israel's history, and if you don't know this history frontwards and backwards, that's perfectly fine. What you need to know right now is that these kingdoms were both conquered. The northern kingdom was conquered by Assyria. 100, 150 or so years later, the southern kingdom of Judah is conquered by Babylon, and they are all shipped off into exile. So we call this the exilic period, where most of the Israelites and people from Judah who are left over are now living in captivity in Babylon, right? Okay. So this is the period of the prophets. We have a whole series of prophets. We're talking Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, what we call the minor prophets, so Hosea, Amos, and they are all writing within this couple hundred year period where these kingdoms are being conquered, trying to warn the people of Israel and Judah that judgment is coming. One of the debates that is still going on, and will probably go on for a very long time, with these prophets. So this is, you know, over half of your Old Testament is prophets, right? One of the debates is, were these prophecies being written in real time? Or were they retroactively written after the fact, after these kingdoms were already conquered, to sort of provide an explanation as to why this had happened? And I hope that that makes sense. So let me put it a slightly different way. We have all of these prophets in the Old Testament warning the people of Israel, warning the people of Judah, that because they have strayed away from the commands of Yahweh, their God, because they have disregarded the law, because social injustice is now permeating the land, because the rich now hold most of the wealth, and because the wealth has all been centralized in the hands of a few people, not that this would probably ever sound familiar to any of us. The prophets are condemning all of these social ills at the same time that they are condemning the people for having strayed away from the true God. Okay. The debate is, were these prophetic texts written in real time before these kingdoms were actually conquered? Or, as other people have suggested, were these texts being written after the fact? Like, say, 100 years after that kingdom was already conquered and the people were already in exile. Were these texts being written retroactively to help the people understand and help to explain why these tragedies had happened to them? That's a debate that is ongoing. I have my own thoughts about it, but for now I'll just alert you to the conversation that is happening there, that it's half of your Old Testament. Okay, so you've got all these prophetic books being written around this time. So we're talking 700s to 500s BC. The people go into exile. The people come back from exile in the late 500s and 400s BC. So these are the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, and some of the events in Chronicles are talking about when the people come back from exile, and now they're going to rebuild the temple, and they're going to reestablish a Jewish identity in what we think of today as the land of Israel, but Palestine in that area, right? So what's happening to the text during that time? We call this time, and the time leading up to Christ, you know, this is a pre-rabbinic period. It's the establishment of what we think of today as the modern Jewish religion, okay? And what's happening then, as we see at Qumran, as we see at the site where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered by the Dead Sea, is that all of these individual scrolls that make up the Old Testament are being copied and recopied and recopied, all by hand, by the way. And they're being collated and assembled into larger groups of text. And eventually, this is going to happen in a standardized fashion, and it becomes what we think of as the Old Testament. Okay? Now, we have the time of Christ, we have the Pharisees and the Sadducees and all these various political parties, right? After that time, so 135 to around 1000 AD, is what we call the Talmudic period. Okay, so the various Talmuds, the various interpretations of the Old Testament are beginning to be published. During the Talmudic period, the scriptures are the Old Testament is still being copied and recopied. But so the thing is, though, we have copies of the Old Testament from, you know, a couple hundred years AD. We have copies of the Old Testament from 1000 AD. And what we're seeing is that those copies agree almost identically. Now, there are differences, and there is an entire field of study that goes into analyzing these differences, but essentially, they're the same text. What that tells us is that the Old Testament, by early on, after either before or after Jesus' life and death and resurrection, the Old Testament has been standardized. You know, people aren't making changes to it. The earliest copies of the Old Testament that we have, and I'm talking complete copies, is there's two copies. There's the Aleppo Codex and the Leningrad Codex. Aleppo dates around 900 AD, the Leningrad about 100 years after that. And of course, you know, from there you've got the printing press, and you've got the printing of Bibles in the 15th century, which is actually now starting to be mass produced, right? Okay, so I want to sort of wrap up our overview. You know, there's not a lot of theology, okay, in this podcast, and I'm not sure how much theology we're going to be able to include in the New Testament version of this podcast either, but as I refine the way that we do these podcasts over time, I would like to find a way to include more application, at least into some of these, but right now, this is a lot of information. The thing that I want to leave you with, though, let's go back to early on in our discussion. When we're talking about these individual scrolls, if you think about a scroll that's just the book of Judges, think about a scroll that's just Psalm 21 and maybe Psalm 53 and maybe Psalm 71. Think about individual scrolls. So this is early on in the development of the Old Testament. And we're thinking about these themes of inerrancy and inspiration. We know that real people are writing down these psalms. We know the real people are recording the book of Judges. They might have even lived through one or two of the battles that are recorded in the book of Judges, and now they're writing down, this is what happened. This is what I saw. Or this is what was told to me firsthand. Now, over time, that scroll is going to get copied. And it might be that somebody's grandson who was also in that battle in the book of Judges. Somebody's grandson begins recopying a scroll and he says, you know what? My granddad told us this other story, this other thing that happened in this battle, and I'm going to add that story into this story. And so the book of Judges, the scroll of Judges begins to grow, and it begins to be edited a little bit here and there, because someone else says, you know what? Not only did this happen, but also this happened. And then you go a little bit farther down the line, and someone says, you know what? The theology of Yahweh begins to develop, and they say, you know, I think the reason why it's interesting that the people in this battle attribute their success to Yahweh, or they attribute their failure because they forgot Yahweh and they began to worship this false god, and that's why they lost the battle. And you know, it's interesting because I was just in this other battle 200 years later, and it's interesting that the same thing happened. And so I'm going to include that story into my story. And I want us to think about real people in real time writing these scrolls out. Is editing okay? If text over time was thoughtfully and carefully added, if things were clarified, if something was unclear, let's say in an earlier version of Deuteronomy, and one of the laws was maybe a bit ambiguous the way that it was written down originally, and a later scribe, as he's recopying the book of Deuteronomy, says, you know, I know what they were trying to say here, but that's not actually what we do. We actually do it this other way. And so he makes this editorial decision to sort of clarify a passage in the book of Deuteronomy. Is that okay? Do we make allowances for that sort of evolution of the text over time? Does that somehow remove its validity as inerrant or inspired as the Word of God, the way that you've heard those terms used? Does that cause problems for you? Or what about this? What if an oral tradition, so example, you know, a story that was being passed down from one generation to another to another, what if that was combined with a later account of the same story in prose form? Is that okay? That's where I want us to get, and that's where I want us to start thinking about is, okay, if there was an editorial process over time that some or most of the books of the Old Testament went through before they got to be to their final accepted form that we use today, should that lessen or should it increase our faith that what we are holding is useful for us in matters of faith, in matters of religious faith? That's the thought that I want to leave you with for today. And when we talk about the New Testament and the history of the New Testament, I want us to ask some of the same questions, but from a New Testament perspective. So, hopefully this is helpful for you. It's been good for me just to look over my notes and to sort of put things back in the big picture from time to time. That helps me as well. Hopefully this was clear. You know, there was a lot of information I just sort of threw at you, and I might be using some terms that aren't as helpful for you as they are for me right now. And if that's the case, would you just let me know that? Seriously, let me know, because, you know, we're going to refine the way that this podcast is presented as time goes on, and I want it to be the most help for you as possible. So use the contact form on the blog. Tell me what's working, what doesn't work, and we will see you next time. Grace and peace to you. We'll see you soon.